We're living in fantastically transformative times, and opportunities to consciously grow up may just be more available than ever. Today's guest, Michael Brown, shares his growing pains that grew into his salvation. His two books are The Presence Process and Alchemy of the Heart. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned. This is Tributaries. Michael, I know you aren't interested in retelling or dwelling on the details of your physical illness that precipitated your journey into consciousness and writing The Presence Process and Alchemy of the Heart. But as you mentioned in the intro to your first book, your personal odyssey could easily be romanticized, but obviously years of pain are not romantic.
No, it's what you do with them that appears to be romantic.
Exactly. You've paid your dues, but how do you convey that to other people, or do you find it necessary to?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I try and convey that. One of the things that did for me was absolutely, without a doubt, convince me that the challenges that come are the fruits. That within the challenges, there's always great invitation into opportunities and insights. And I think that when someone goes in and does something like the presence process, and instead of running from what's causing their discomfort or from what they're resisting, and instead entering it consciously and then realizing the benefits of doing so, then it becomes kind of self-explanatory.
Yes.
But I think I had to see that in a very sort of long, drawn-out, and acute way. And now I don't want anyone to take my hardship from me. It even changed the way I saw someone like Jesus, for example. We're told Jesus went around healing people, and I really question that, because if someone had come and touched me and taken away my agony, they would have taken away all the benefit that others have received from me realizing, the causal point of my own, condition. So, it just, going through that helped me to realize that things are not what they seem, and when something really tough is happening, that it's an opportunity. And even a small example is yesterday, I got a phone call from the person who owns the house I'm in telling me that someone was coming to look at my house, wanting to buy it, the house I'm living in. And of course, immediately I got, my heart went dum, 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 because I love the house I'm living in. I don't want someone to come and buy it. And the person walked in, and I had a very deep connection and meaningful connection with this person, and we were obviously meant to meet. And I was able to send them off to meet someone else that I knew that they needed to meet. And a lot of that, I welcomed them into the house and I made them comfortable, even though they were supposedly coming in to buy the house. But prior to that experience of them even arriving at my house, when my heart started going dum 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 and I started becoming nervous about the fact that my house that I'm living in could be sold from underneath me, I just sat with that all through the day, with that discomfort, knowing that that was a gift. And that if I sat with it and I was absolutely conscious with that nervousness or whatever that feeling was that was coming up, that something wonderful would come out of it. And it did. So it's really changed the way that I engage with the experiences in my life. And I think that's one of the things that people see once they've gone through the experiential, version of the presence process or any emotional cleansing procedure, is that those things that we most fear or that we run from are often where the greatest gems and insights await us.
Yes, I had a similar experience yesterday where I was going to have to come up with a bunch of money for something. And after the boom, boom, boom of the heart, I really honestly experienced this thing of feeling like this is great. It's going to really help me get bigger in so many ways.
Yes.
And the fact that I was able to go to that place just made me grateful for all the work I've been doing.
Yes.
And as you say, the more you practice the presence, It's magnetic, isn't it?
Yes. And you know, maybe a couple of years ago or even longer, if that experience had happened to me, I would have reacted. I would have probably have phoned the owner of the house and said, you know, you said you'd taken it off the market. You said you'd wait for me to be able to buy it. You know, I would have probably have been not as warm and welcoming to the person coming to the door wanting to buy the house. I would have behaved in a very reactive way as opposed to a responsive way. And, you know, I was also talking to someone today, and I was saying the things that we are being faced with today are leading us, you know, I know they're leading us into something else. And for example, what I'm saying by that is that I feel that as humanity, we're going to be entering experiences that are going to make our hearts go dum, 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 because they're going to be so unfamiliar and not what our plans are about, not what we think we want, but we are going to enter these experiences. And if we react, it's going to be our destruction. If we respond by being still and knowing that it comes as a blessing from the universe, it's going to lead to all sorts of profound transformation. So, you know, I still see the presence process, even though we're dealing with our own individual emotional signatures and stuff, I still see it as a way of training ourselves for engaging with the future or a paradigm that we're entering as a planet.
Right, and I think in our evolution into and through this paradigm, we've certainly reached a place in humanity where the opportunity, perhaps now more than ever, does avail itself to work through the mind to the spirit. And science, of course, is, you know, in some ways paving that road, and it's one example of how that's going on. But there's also a temptation to stop there and allow the intellectual satisfaction instead of actually making that next step really into the spiritual and that experiential of the spiritual. That's why there's a danger of, you know, I read that self-help book, you know, and that might satiate something.
It's the same,
for
it's the
a
same with
while.
Technology. You know, it's the same. You know, when an expression came up in my mind the other day, don't let technology fool you to believe it can take you where only the heart can go. And you know, I feel that that's kind of a crossroads we're at the moment, where there's so many people relying more and more on technology as a hope for the future, and not realizing that developing their own heart capacities, their own felt perception, is maybe not more important, but as important as all the other developments happening in the world. And to me, I see that the next development that we have to go through, or that we're being invited to enter, is quite emotional on a level of felt perception and not so much on thinking and understanding. I think we've got almost to the limit of thinking and understanding. Now we have to kind of feel our way beyond that right now.
Yes, and feeding into that, you know, okay, we've got the technology. Let the technology do our addition for us. That will leave us room to actually develop the emotional.
Yes.
That we're being allowed more time for that. Would you share the time frame of your what you explain as your three present awareness experiences and how they became the barometer for your path?
Those happened over a period of, you know, that was my intense kind of experiential journey of discovery, which has by no means ended. But the journey that I went through that came out as the presence process, you know, that started around 1994 and kind of completed itself in 1999. 1999 was a big crucial year for me, and I think for everybody. And the elders also in Mexico told me 1999 was when we became emotionally awakened. So it was a very powerful year for many of us. So I went through that experience sort of from 1994 to about 1999 into 2000, and then kind of stopped there. And then there was a pause of about a year when I just kind of went, what's been going on? And then things fell into place and I started putting the book together and working with people and facilitating. But those presence experiences, you know, which was the one was from, you know, the peyote ceremonies, the one was from the rebirthing, and I can't remember what the third one was. But they all happened in that in the latter part of the 90s. The Sweat Lodge was the other one, yes.
Yeah, and you didn't dwell on any of those as the vehicle necessarily.
Well, I think at the time when one has the experience, any profound experience, the mind's addiction is to cling onto it, try and figure it out, analyze it, and repeat it as often as possible, and try and live in that place. So I think we automatically, if I have a profound experience with breathing, for example, then next day I get up, I want to go and repeat that because the mind is addicted to doing things over and over again and trying to figure, well, the mental body, not so much the mind, the mental body. So yes, I did. You know, when I had a profound experience with breathing, of course, I went and breathed like, you know, 2 to 3 hours a day for nearly 2 years trying to, you know, repeat things. And it was the same thing with the peyote ceremonies. You know, I stayed in that ceremonial environment for nearly 4 years. The same thing with sweat lodges. You know, when I had that profound experience in sweat lodge, it caused me to return. But I have since learned that the word is through, you know, and that every experience, especially the profound ones that we awake, that are awakening for us, are experiences to be moved through. I think it was Timothy Leary who said, grab hold tightly and let go lightly. In other words, when you're having the experience, you know, really suck it up and take out every juice of that experience. But as it starts to leave you, you know, open your hand and gently let it go instead of trying to hold on to it and make it repeat and repeat again. And I'm sure that many people have awakening experiences exactly like I did, but through different mechanisms. So the modality almost appears to be irrelevant. You know, people who hear that, you know, peyote had an effect on me, they then want to run and go and take peyote. And I always say, if peyote isn't around you, don't go and seek it out. If the sweat lodge isn't around you, don't go and seek it out. All those experiences that came to me that were awakening experiences were given to me. They were brought to me. I never went and sought them out. It was almost like I was taken to them and given them. I didn't. Everything that I've tried to do out of thinking out of my mental body, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do on the next step of my journey, and I'm trying to make it happen. Those have always been dismal failures. It's been the unexpected gifts from the universe that have been the points of awakening. And what serves as a point of awakening for me is not necessarily going to be a point of awakening for you or for somebody else, because our life experiences are custom designed, uniquely custom designed for each of our own individual requirements.
Yes, and to quote you, you say that pain is a portal, and of course that's what you've been talking about right now.
Yes.
And
yes.
And you also talk about perceptual tools. I'm wondering if you would elaborate on that a little bit. I, for one, I've always felt like rationalization was one of man's greatest tool. However, I don't feel like it leads us to the greatest
end. When I'm talking about a perceptual tool, I'm talking about, you know, the use of the mental body to cause a point of awakening in ourselves. So the mental body can be used as a catalyst, as a point of awakening. And a very simple one, for example, is if you say to somebody, you know, look at the word beautiful. And they look at the word beautiful, and of course they look at it mentally, because beautiful has a mental definition that you can go and look up in a book. But you can say to someone, well, look at the word beautiful and listen to it. It says beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. When you look at the word like that, it gives you a whole different resonance of when I am really totally present and being within myself, that is a beautiful thing, beautiful. Suddenly you have a different perception of the word. That's what I'm talking about as far as a perceptual tool. It's using language to change the way we look at something without even doing anything. You just, you know, it changes immediately if you use the tool. And in the presence process, the entire book and in Alchemy of the Heart, both books are littered with perceptual tools because I love them. I just, they tickle me, so I like to share them as much as possible. And even the pathway of awareness, you know, in showing someone the pathway of awareness, that for the first 7 years we're emotional and we're children, and the next 7 years we go into a very extreme mental development. We even go to school around seven, and then 14, you know, we enter a very physical development and an increasingly physicalized relationship with our reality until we're 21, and then in 21 we have a birthday, because a big birthday, because we celebrate our arrival in adulthood. And what we've gone is gone through a pathway in which our awareness has moved along the emotional, then the mental, then into the physical. And so if we want to return to the causal point, we reverse that by first entering the physical body, becoming mentally clear, and then entering an awareness of the authentic condition of our emotional body. When you show someone that pathway of awareness and they see it for the first time in their life, that again is using a perceptual tool to adjust the way someone perceives their experience.
Right. Well, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, in your book, you do say how a child's emotional growth starts drastically slowing down at age seven. So,
right.
If they do go on for another 7 years and really develop their mental, then perhaps that's okay. But if someone doesn't develop emotionally after that age of seven, then obviously they're going to be dealing with some very, a lot of barriers in their life.
And well, they make for good politicians.
That was a loaded laugh, Michael.
Not all our politicians, but, many world leaders, you can look at the conflicts in the world, are really behaving like seven-year-olds in a playground. They're really behaving on an emotional level of a seven-year-old. So one can develop one's mentality and become very intelligent intellectually, and one can develop one's physical being, by just the most basic of nutrition to have a fully developed adult body. But emotional development doesn't, it requires conscious development. And when we go into a schooling environment at the age of seven, it depends, of course, on what school, but I'm just talking about general,
yes,
what we would call government bred school,
yes,
you churn out the education system. On that level, emotional development is not at all encouraged. In fact, it's discouraged, and it probably is necessary so that there's enough stillness physically and mentally to start developing the mental body. But there comes a point in our lives when we, and it probably reoccurs on many times during the day as adults, when we are given the opportunity to pick up and continue our emotional development. And that's usually whatever point upsets us in our life. Anything that it upsets us is an opportunity to pick up on our emotional development and to integrate the things in our emotional body that are keeping us stunted in that place.
Right. So from your experience, both your own personally and then working with so many people doing this work and in encouragement and suggesting a path, is there something you could say or you'd want to say to parents and how they can perhaps encourage or continue some type of emotional development and growth?
For the children?
Yeah.
Well, I'm a campaigner for the children in the way that I say, leave them alone. Whenever a parent asks me how they can assist their child to continue emotional development, I'll always say the same thing. A child learns through example. In other words, right, what a child is going to do, it's going to copy the way the parent's energy field, the way a parent is responding to its own emotional development. If a parent, I remember being exposed, in fact, I was having this conversation with someone this morning over breakfast. I remember when I was in my early 20s, being exposed to a family in which both the mother and the father were psychologists, and the mother was particularly interested in emotional development. And there were these two girls, the daughters in the family, and they were twins. And I remember being in absolute awe and also not inferior, but feeling a little bit daunted by the fact that I knew that these girls, who were probably 3 or 4 years younger than me, were emotionally 20 years older than me. I could see that they had all these internal tools that I just had no comprehension of. And they weren't taught those tools by their parents verbally. They were taught those tools by the way their parents had lived their lives. So if a parent takes responsibility for their own emotional condition and starts at that point, the child automatically begins to follow that example. You can't tell someone to do emotional development. You can only example it for someone, set an example, especially when the parent-child situation. A child always inherits the emotional condition of the parent. And it doesn't. And the funny thing is, it doesn't matter at what age the parent starts to do their emotional work. If a parent only starts to do their emotional work at the age of 50, and their child is already in their 20s, that adjustment that the parent makes on their own energetic system, because the emotional body is the energy in motion body. Emotional is just an abbreviation for energy in motion. If a parent starts freeing up their own blocked energies at the age of 50, when their children are not even living at home anymore, it's still going to energetically impact the child.
Yes.
Because the family is connected energetically at that level. And anyone in the family who makes any authentic change to the causal point of their own energetic system impacts the rest of the family. And that's why this work is, you know, do unto yourself as you would have others do. You know, be the way you want others to be in the world. And I've seen that in my own family by impacting my own energy field, seeing what impact that had on my family. And then I had the wonderful privilege of facilitating my mother through this process in about 2002, 2003. And boy, and my mother's the man, you know, she's the head of the family. And when my mother decided to do her emotional work and go through the presence process, all hell broke loose in our family.
I can only imagine.
Absolutely. And today, every one of us children are in such a profoundly free state because my mother chose to do that work. She didn't do it to us. She did it to herself.
Exactly.
And that's what alchemy is about. You know, alchemy is that whatever I want achieved in the world, I must first achieve within myself.
Yeah, I was speaking with someone the other day, and they were talking about how they were really gung-ho about, you know, being very green and wanting to save the earth and all of that. And it's very interesting to see how people move into the mode of protection. And Bruce Lipton is a wonderful man. He wrote The Biology of Belief, and he began his professional career as a cellular biologist. And he found that the cell, there was no way the cell could be both in a growth phase and a protection phase or mode at the same time. So it's an either or. So to spend our time in that mode of protection is ultimately fruitless.
Yes. And also, you know, the common example I use is of someone saying, I must save Mother Earth, I must save Gaia.
Yeah, what are you saving it from?
And yet they can't sit at the dinner table in peace with their own mother. And what they don't realize is there is no difference between, for example, me and my relationship with my mother and my relationship with matter and my relationship with the Earth. They're all the same relationship. But the causal point is first to find that within myself. How am I nurturing myself within this physical vehicle before I go fiddling with anything around me? And if I actually start getting that right, the radiance of that into my experience it has a real authentic impact.
Right.
Whereas if I go around trying to save the whales and I'm actually not taking care of myself, whatever I do, you know, it's the same, you know, what I say is, also is that whatever the causal point is of our activity is the outcome. So if I'm trying to save this earth because I'm terrified of what's happening, all I'm doing is sowing seeds of terror. If I'm trying to change somebody because I'm angry with them, all I'm doing is sowing seeds of anger. So it's very important what the causal point is. If someone is trying to help the earth or trying to help communities, and they are genuinely doing it from a place of peace. In other words, their own heart is at peace. Then the outcome of everything they do will be peaceful. And I think one of the prime examples of this very thing playing out is, for example, an organization like the UN, which has full of good intent, goes into countries to try and help people, but because a lot of it is done out of fear, the outcome is fearful. I mean, if you look at almost any country in which the UN has gone to try and supposedly help people, you will find that those countries are left in shambles, because the causal point and the outcome will always be the same. So yes, I'm all in favor of people going around and assisting people and trying to make a difference in this world. But if we are not doing it from a place of peace, then the outcome is not going to be peace. So if I'm trying to save the whales because I'm afraid of what's going on around me, then all my actions is going to do is going to sow seeds of fear in the world.
Yes. There's a great saying, if you think you're fully conscious, go home for the holidays.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you think you are enlightened, go home for Thanksgiving. That's absolutely true.
Right.
I mean, in that level, my family, you know, are some of my greatest teachers, because my family, my mother lives down the road from me. I mean, I can throw a stone and hit her house from here. And if I want to know what's going on with me really and how it is, I just have to go and visit my mother. She'll reflect it immediately. But it's not about her. It's always about what's going on internally inside of me. My family will always be an absolute clear reflection of what's going on inside of me. They're meant to be. You know, our family is the cross we come to bear.
Right.
And my mother... Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, my mother will show me my relationship with the material world, mother, matter, nurturing. My father will show me my relationship with the spiritual world and how I'm relating to my inner guidance. My brother will show me about experience and whether I'm able to take my own experience, my life as valid as a teaching. And my sister will show me of how well I'm integrating my experiences, how well I'm emotionally being able to digest what's going on around me.
This is a good place to really jump in with what I know of the Aborigines down in Australia, who think if someone from Africa walked through their village, they would be considered a cousin. I mean, that's as far out they go with relations.
Yes.
And so we need to make an awareness of that in ourselves, that every person is that reflection, and whether it's blood, mother, or father or not, it has the same resonance value.
What I have seen through my experience and through others doing the work, if I integrate the emotional signature or the felt discomfort that is being reflected back to me through my own family, I actually free myself of that birth family as being what I call my family. They then become my brothers and sisters, and I enter the family of humanity in which everybody is my family. We only stay really holding on to those few individuals as being our absolute family because we're blood related, while we haven't integrated the emotional signature that they're reflecting. And in that light, I say there are only dysfunctional families. While families stay together as needy, tight-knit units with all this drama going on between those individuals, while the emotional signature remains unintegrated, the moment that emotional signature is integrated, which can be done by any one person in that family, and usually it only requires one, once that emotional signature being mirrored within the family and brought from generation to generation is integrated, every member of that family is released and can then enter the family of humanity.
Part 2 with Michael Brown next week. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and podcasts are where you would hope to find them. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.